Chester, we've talked about the issues relating to the Honor Court and sexual conflicts, and this is intertwined in some respects with the issue of campus safety in general. I remember when you first took the job in this studio, in this room, the first question I asked you was, what was your top priority? And you said it was campus safety. How do you appraise how well you've done in that?
Well, I think we've done some really important things. When I was first coming in, was in the wake of Virginia Tech, and we're still feeling the loss of Eve Carson. And so that's, I'm sure, why I gave you that answer, and I think it was the right answer. We set up the text messaging system and the sirens. We've gotten that up and going. We have frequent tabletop exercises where we, and sometimes live exercises where we practice how we will respond to a major campus incident. And so I think that our capabilities, we have an emergency management team and we have phone numbers that we all call into, and we practice that and drill that. So we're hopefully none of that will ever get tested. But if it does, we know the text messaging works, and we know we've practiced calling into our numbers, and we know who makes decisions about what when these kinds of things happen. And so I feel like we've moved a long way on that. And Chief McCracken, I think, is regarded as one of the great police chiefs in higher education. He was selected for what's called the National Academy up at Quantico to get training for these kinds of events. And so I think that, you know, we've come a long way. There's every campus, when they send out alerts about incidents that are not, you know, a live shooter, gets a lot of commentary from the student press about whether the alert should have been sent out or should not have been sent out. And that's something that that is true. If you just look at every college newspaper in the country, you can find probably on any given day 25 editorials about whether the alert should or should not have been used. But the good thing is, when people are arguing about that and it's not a highly serious incident, what that shows is that the alert system works and that it's in place there. And I think we've done a good job of putting ours in place so that in the event that we did have a very serious incident, we would be able to communicate with people. And we've practiced our procedures for that.
Chancellor, you mentioned the Eve Carson murder. That was off campus, and it was not a terrorist activity. It was a murder, and we have the unsolved murder of Faith Daniel Hedgepeth. This one's a puzzle because the case files have been sealed, and we understand they're sealed until May the 12th. What role can your administration play, if any, in matters of that kind?
Well, when Chapel Hill or Carrboro is investigating a death, we try to respect their jurisdiction as much as we can. They don't share a lot of details with us, and I can understand why, because we have so many people who are asking us various things about these cases. And so we respect their ability to carry out their investigation. So what we do is try to provide support to the people who are dealing with these tragedies, make sure they know how to get to counseling and wellness, and that you know, and that if the police department needs any information, that we work with them to get it as quickly as possible.
One of the spinoffs of the Melinda Manning, Landon Gamble stories is the formation of that group called Safer Carolina. I think that's an acronym for something. There have been multiple rallies on the campus demanding better protection for sexual assault victims on the campus. They're a challenge to whether the university has a sense that the university has created an appropriately safe environment. Are those rallies unfair to you?
I'm glad people are talking about this. The thing that I think your listeners need to understand is that we have obligations that are spelled out by the Department of Education in something called the Dear Colleague Letter, which is a very complicated document. It's not quite as complicated as the instrument for the Honor Court that we were talking about, but it's very complicated in terms of the obligations that we have. And not everybody agrees about what those obligations should be. But the federal government has told us what they are, and so that's what we adhere to. And what we are all universities are trying to do is to carry out our adjudicatory obligations that are spelled out in the Dear Colleague letter and balance that with providing support to victims of sexual assault who are important people in our community who need to be supported. And that is challenging, and this whole national debate that you see playing out is about how is that best to be done. And right now, you know, we have our case at North Carolina, but Swarthmore and Occidental College were the ones in the news last week. And, you know, next week it'll probably be two different schools. And this is a movement that's playing out around the country. And frankly, I think it's a movement that the Department of Education anticipated when they sent out the guidance that they sent out. And again, it's a good thing that we're acknowledging that these sexual assaults are occurring and we're trying to do something about it. These things have been going on in college campuses for as long as college campuses have been around.
That does bring up an interesting question in general, and that is whether society, whether campuses in general, are they really more or less dangerous than they were 50 years ago, or does the danger just get a better press?
Yeah, I think it's hard to assess that in absolute terms, but again, I think that, you know, we have the alerts and we have the disaster preparedness work that we do, and you know, information is shared much more quickly, and so I'd say that we're probably are safer, but it doesn't appear that way because we know a lot more about what's going on.
Chancellor, I want to turn to the AFAM scandal while we're talking about aberrations. I suspect that all of our listeners know about the AFAM scandal, the Department of African American Studies. It's maybe one of the most convoluted scandals that I can ever recall in my time here. We had an African American department chair, Julius Nyangoro. Is that pronounced?
Nangora.
Right? Nangora. I always say that wrong. Nangora, like Angora, like the sweater. Giving out passing grades for fake classes that never met. That overlapped the athletic scandal and made that worse. It involved plagiarism by a football player, the apparent accidental posting of the academic record of Julius Peppers, now a rich and famous star in the NFL. You know, I think if Andy Griffith were around here, he probably would have said, and I don't know what all. I'm not trying to make light of it, but have you ever seen anything quite like that?
I get that question a lot, and I try not to speculate on sort of the relative complicated features of this. But no, there's no question that this was a very complicated story and one that is embarrassing and unprofessional for the university and something that went on far too long and should have been caught a lot sooner. And the underlying politics of it all are very, very complicated. And I guess it's an overused phrase, but I think it's fair to say it's a perfect storm.
Well, when you think about it, I can't think of a particular cost at this stage to just speculating. The most interesting thing about all of that would be, what was his motive? Can you speculate? What do you believe his motive might have been?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that Julius Nangoro knew about these things and I'm sure participated to some extent, but Debbie Crowder, who was the department manager, according to Jim Martin and the various analyses that we've done, was the one who was carrying these things out. And everything we've heard about her is that she wanted to help students. And so students came to her office and they needed a class to graduate or they needed extra help, and they got more than they should have. And that comes from a very wholesome and important thing about universities, which is most of us work here because we want to help students. And it's the university's job to make sure that those people don't provide the students too much help. And we failed at that in this case and did so for a long period of time, since 1997. It would appear from Jim Martin. So there are a lot of people who could have picked this up. I don't think there was any malicious intent behind the fact that nobody found it. But again, it goes back to what we were saying earlier, that we can't kid ourselves about the fact that these things can happen in Chapel Hill. We need to acknowledge the fact that these things can happen, and if we do that, it frees us to catch them when they do. I think the procedures that we've put in place have been reviewed multiple times, and everybody agrees that we put procedures and policies in place to keep this from happening, but that doesn't excuse the fact that lots of deans and lots of provosts and lots of other people should have caught this for 14 years.
So Debbie Crowder was probably the instigator of this, and we could just say, and we don't know what her motivation is, except perhaps she loved too much. Would that be what you're saying?
Yes, I think that's right. And then in terms of the athletics part, you know, I think there's been all this discussion about whether it was an athletics thing or wasn't an athletics thing. Of course, the athletes knew about this, and we have been transparent about the fact that Debbie Crowder is the longtime partner of Warren Martin, and it was in the Martin Report, and in my opinion, and maybe not acknowledged to the extent that it should have been, that Burgess McSwain, the longtime basketball tutor, was a close friend of Debbie Crowder's. So that provided the access to what was going on. And I think that is just the simple analysis about this whole question of whether it was an athletic scandal or an academic scandal. It just boils down to that.
Is anyone subject to criminal prosecution in that?
I don't believe so, but that's being investigated externally.
Well, other than just being more careful, what can we learn from the experience? Are you comfortable with the changes that you've made in oversight?
I mean, the only thing that worries me about the changes in oversight is whether it's overkill and whether we'll be able to sustain it. So I think there's no question that we've got lots of policies in place to catch this kind of thing. But I think more importantly, in terms of the culture, as I've said numerous times in this interview, is, you know, recognizing that this place isn't perfect and things can happen here. And this happened for 14 years, and lots of great, great people who served this university well were administrators during that time, and none of us caught this. So that's just something that we got to be open and honest with each other about.
We'll talk about the nature of the university and what the chancellor may want to leave us with when we continue.